Welcome to Profiling Criminal Minds. I'm Dan.
Sheila.
And we're back for more Season 4 of Criminal Minds. I was going to try and do a clever thing to talk about what we're going to see this week, but it's just a weird week, so there's no way to easily segue into it. It's a very strange assemblage of episodes, because the first two are complete frivolity that weirdly end the exact same way. Like, I had forgotten these episodes were next to each other. And I'm like, were they not written to be next to each other? Because it's like, I feel like if you had been planning this season out, you wouldn't have ended two episodes the exact same way. But you know what? We'll get there. Before we get started on the episodes, though, I have Criminal Minds news. Okay. And we've talked a lot about how our favorite TV couple pretty much ever is JJ and Will on Criminal Minds. They're the most stable couple. They're the happiest marriage. They're just the best. And apparently the actors get along really well, because Josh Stewart, and I don't know if you know this about Josh Stewart, he occasionally makes movies.
Yeah.
He's a filmmaker as well. He writes and directs movies. He wrote a movie, and it's really embarrassing that I can't remember the title of the movie, because I was so taken by the alternate title, like the original title, before it was, before, you know, the marketing people got a hold of it. It was called Tree Huggers, and it's about a guy who wants to, you know, go out and start a show about bow hunting, and it's a found footage horror movie. He wrote and directed. It's actually pretty good. I enjoyed it quite a bit. But anyway, I don't remember what it's called. You can just look up Josh Stewart. It's called alternately called Tree Huggers. But anyway, he's made another movie. This one's a drama about opioid abuse in rural Appalachia. I guess there is no... I guess rural Appalachia is probably redundancy. There aren't a lot of giant cities in Appalachia, but you know what I was trying to get at. Anyway, and yes, he has cast AJ Cook as his wife in the movie. So it's like, yeah, way to go, the two of them, for still working together, whether there's going to keep being a show or not. So thumbs up to Josh Stewart and AJ Cook, our favorite TV couple. But yes, let's get started with the episodes.
Okay.
Just a moment. Please, go.
This week, we are actually, contrary to what we told you, we are doing four episodes.
Oh, yes, because one of them was a cliffhanger, and we're like, yeah, we're not going to end on a cliffhanger. That would just be mean.
Yeah, it would be mean. And besides, it would give you not too much to talk about if you ended up on the cliffhanger.
Yes, that's true. All right, so let's go for it.
Okay. So the first one is Paradise, starring Will Wheaton as their villain. Mm-hmm. When authorities in La Plata County, Colorado, receive a 911 call. Oh, no, what? Sorry. When three unrelated cars there in Nevada are revealed to have been staged, the BAU attempts to catch an unsub who psychologically torments traveling couples before he has a chance to kill again.
Okay. And yeah, the killer's Will Wheaton. They make you wait half of the episode before he shows up, because they want to do a thing where it's weird how they want to do a thing where they're trying to figure out who the killer is, and they're going through all of the people who work in the area, and it's all very plausible, all very well done. And then you get this weird situation where, well, the second Will Wheaton shows up, the audience is going to know he's the killer. So let's just hold that back as long as we possibly can, which is the right thing to do. I just thought it was pretty funny the way they hold off on showing us Will Wheaton for such an extended period of time. I'm like, oh, I forgot he's only in like a third of this episode.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so this is I don't know if this is the episode that inspired me to create the Prentice Award for the dumbest thing said by an FBI agent. But it wouldn't surprise me if it was, because of one line in this episode that I'm like, that's the dumbest thing any of these characters has ever said.
Okay.
So the Will Wheaton character, he he brutally tortures and rapes and murders these couples. Then he puts them in a car, and then he puts the car out on the road where it'll get hit by a truck. And somehow no one has noticed until this third time that they were already dead when they got hit by a truck. But you know what? I'm not going to question the competence of various cops. That's not what we're here to do. So then they're talking about this, and you understand, okay, that's an interesting way to get rid of the bodies, blah, 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 blah. And then Emily starts talking about how, wait a minute, the dead victims were missing their underwear. That means that to him, creating a car accident was a final extra rape. And I'm like, what? What are you talking about? That's the craziest thing anyone has ever said on this show. No, that is not what I think when I hear that. They continue trying to say that there is a sexual component to the car accident. So I'm like, you have no reason to believe that or suspect that. That's just a crazy thing to think, especially when elsewhere in the episode you acknowledge that, you know, a lot of these guys steal and keep underwear.
Yeah.
Like, the missing underwear is a far more likely a serial killer's trophy than it is a way to make it so she is being metaphorically raped by being in a car accident. But she says it with a straight face, and everyone acts like, brilliant observation. Brilliant observation, Emily. This will 100% factor into our decision-making from here on. I'm like, how? How will this factor into your decision-making from here on? She just spouted gibberish.
Well, it's Messer and Fishers.
No, you're right. They do like episodes about this kind of unpleasant violence against women. That is their brand.
And it's funny. I was just talking about sort of rape is rape, right?
Yeah.
But anyway, yesterday. But I don't want to go there. I mean, this whole episode is so weird.
William Mapother's in this episode. That's something. Pardon? William Mapother's in this episode. He's the husband.
Who we'll
be seeing again in a key episode of The Inside when we watch that show later on. So be on the lookout for him.
We'll be on the lookout for him. But this episode is just so... It slips out of my mind.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. There's very little to hold on to in this episode. I completely agree with that.
You know, like, what do you talk? Psychologically torment? Well, no, I mean, these people
keeps them locked up for a couple of days.
And they mention, but there's no setup for any insights. The guy isn't drunk when they were driving.
No.
Or anything like that. She's the one, you know, when they're talking in the beginning and they see this motel.
Yeah, this ridiculous idea that they get into this fight over whose fault it was that they went to the hotel, and she had wanted it because he was too tired to drive. And then, actually, the weird part is, I'm like, they have this thing where they were planning to drive straight through, and then she blames him for, you know, getting hung over so they didn't get on the road fast enough. But it was already, like, well past dark when they pulled over the side of the road and he was too tired to drive. And the next day they're like, in just 8 more hours, you're going to be home. And I'm like, even if he hadn't gotten hung over the night, drunk too much the night before and been hung over, like, there was another 8 hours in that drive. I don't think he delayed you 8 hours that morning. Like, don't think she was right in her complaint to him.
Well, no, she's just, but that's just sort of anger and frustration when you say stupid things, right?
It's true.
And they should have never, like, it sounds to me they're trying to make a 16-hour drive in one day, which is stupid.
I have done once, and I will never try to do it again. Don't try to do a 16-hour drive in one day, people. It's terrible.
I have
done it. Yeah, I know you've done it.
Oh, yes. But you've got two drivers and you switch driving.
Yeah, you got two drivers, you switch drivers. You shouldn't do it.
It's not a good idea to do it.
No. Right? I mean, unless you're involved in some kind of a, what do you call it, Paris-Dakar rally type of situation, do not try to drive that many hours in one day.
Yeah, it's not healthy.
No, it's really not.
No, you don't have to get to Mexico in one day.
Oh my God. From Sault Ste. Marie. That is a terrifying idea. Mexico, yeah. Sault Ste. Marie in one day.
Yeah, well, you know.
Geographically possible, you know.
Yeah. Well, you just go straight down, right?
Yeah, you go due south and you will get there.
You have to switch a few. there was a great Chinese restaurant in Indianapolis.
Mm. Yeah, and then, I'm trying to picture. Yeah, okay, that's where you'd stop for lunch. I get it. Yeah, okay.
There's places. They had great chicken livers.
You're not saying it wasn't a fun drive. You're saying it's a crazy idea that no one should do.
I'm saying it's a crazy idea.
Yeah, because you're sending out some mixed messages right now by reminiscing about the food. but anyway,
let's get away from that. We're talking about long drive. Well, it does relate, but they're long drives, and I don't. Well, we didn't do it in one day, but we did do almost
16-hour days, 2 days in a row, or something like that.
Like it was just like, madness. Whoa! I left from Houghton, Michigan, instead of Sault Ste. Marie, and then just drove. I think we made it past Memphis into Texas.
That's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the thing about this episode is, how shall I put this? It's like, it's pretty run of the mill from a standpoint of just investigation. Like literally they're like, okay, well, there's a rapist running around. Who are the rapists in the area? You know, like it's actually not that hard to find him. The only real thing that happens is that, there's a moment of doubt for Aaron because Aaron goes in and he talks to the guy and he doesn't realize it's the killer, and he really wants to beat himself up out of that afterwards. And then David tells him something that's right, which is, you can't expect you're always going to know who the killer is just by looking at him.
Yeah.
And like, that's a crazy expectation to have for yourself.
That you should have had a feeling that it was this guy? My heavens, he had Hummels.
I know.
Okay, so they were his mother's Hummels.
Doesn't matter. Like, yeah, like that's the kind of thing that disarms people. It's a reasonable thing to be disarmed by. Cute little figures of, I don't know, what are Hummels? Just like kids doing stuff or like milkmaids and or
people,
whatnot.
Different people. Yeah, different types of people and different types of jobs.
Yeah, they're cute little porcelain figures. Figurines. They're the most harmless things in the world.
Yeah.
And they really are the most harmless things in the world. Yeah, like, I understand how you'd be disarmed by him, and I guess the show didn't establish, like, I think the only reason you could beat up Aaron for this one is the show didn't properly enough establish that they went to, like, 30 motels that day. Exhausting work doing that kind of canvassing. Of course he's not going to notice every little thing.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know that it would be possible to notice every little thing under those circumstances. So, yeah, I don't blame Aaron for not immediately sussing him out, and he shouldn't blame himself. But yeah, it's just one of those generically bleak episodes where they want to wallow in unpleasantness, and they have the husband and wife turning on each other, and Will Wheaton gloating about how much he loves murder, and I'm like, thanks.
Yeah,
I don't know if this is. I mean, I don't know if this is really what I come to television for.
We kept watching the show.
That's true. It's like, but this kind of wallowing in misery and this much of giving a platform. I mean, it's weird because I know he's not a real person with real opinions, but giving a platform to the mind of the killer in this kind of a way just seems like a weird thing to do.
Well, there was no depth to it. There was no interest to it. It was just plain and simple. They explained everything. So basically Will Wheaton had nothing to do.
It's true. Yeah. Like, you know, it's not like really we have a moment to, you're right. They completely explain all of his stuff. So it's like all Will Wheaton has to do there is torment and gloat. and beat people up.
And they only, you know, I mean, they only show him, you know, he's completely uninterested in any of this sort of stuff. The FBI is, like, I don't know. I mean, there was something drastically missing from this. And I think maybe it's because, the killer, the killer isn't. I mean, the thing that I remember the most, like when I'm thinking visually about the whole thing, is the poor truck driver who says, but why can't I tell everybody thinks I killed this couple and why can't I tell them I didn't?
Yeah.
You know, please, please, please just don't until
we need
until
a couple of days. Yeah. We need a couple of days to catch this guy. Then you can shout it from the rooftops and then we will help you not get sued by the family of the dead people.
Yeah.
Which, you that know. Is a nice touch, that they actually mentioned that of course he would get sued.
The father was going to sue him, you know. Now, mind you, of course, he and the truck driver don't ever really see one another, but that's not the point. I mean, and Aaron does say, well, you know, we need you to keep it quiet, but they were dead when the truck driver
I do them. Like that Aaron immediately intervenes to, like, stop the guy from making it worse. Because, like, trying to do a lawsuit and wallowing in this kind of anger now, like, it's going to be harder later. Like, he can say, like, even though he's risking things by telling him now, it's like, just for the guy's peace of mind, he should know that this wasn't an accident, there was a murderer, and he's going to get caught.
Yeah.
So that was nice.
Yeah, no, that, but as I said, that to me is when I think, and I only watched them yesterday, so.
Okay.
It's not like I watched it a long time ago so that it's gone from my mind, but
it's the kind of ephemera that drains out of your episode.
Yeah, there's no visual elements. Like, I think the opening was quite effective.
Yeah, although, you know, I gotta say, the opening, it's like, hi, we were not able to license the rights to the song Highway to Hell. Here is a really sad attempt at a sound alike. Like, how else can you describe that song?
Yeah, that's right. Like, well, and that is, and I don't know why did they not bother. Maybe they just didn't
bother trying to get. No, it's just too expensive. That's all it is. They would always try to get the song on a show like this, and I'm sure that they called up, oh my God, AC/DC. That took me too long. And they were like, how much is this thing? And they're like, $800,000 or some crazy amount like that. And then they were like, okay, no. We'll just pay a guy $20,000 to record a fake version
of Highway to Hell
that we own the rights to. And that's exactly what they did. It's interesting.
Or actually, I would assume the writers. But it's the same thing with when they use
the musicians. Sometimes the musicians do it, honestly. Sometimes the musicians do it, and sometimes they hire a person to do it.
Yeah. Well, like, because they used a cover for the Rolling Stones.
Yes, when they had the Rolling Stones song. Yeah, they had to use a cover because it would be too expensive to do that.
Yeah,
they had it would be too expensive to do the real version. Yeah, that's another great example.
Yeah, right? But that one, at least they found a cover band.
I know.
You think they couldn't have found maybe nobody else
because
recorded Highway to Hell.
Well, no, that's the interest. Well, first off, you can hire someone to record Highway to Hell, but you still have to pay for the rights to use the song. Like, I think it's a situation where Sympathy of the Devil, it's the song itself isn't that expensive, but a Stones recording is. Whereas something like Highway to Hell, it might be expensive just to record the song. Like, because it's entirely up to the song's the publishers, how much it costs to record and produce a cover. So,
as I understand it, you can use 45 seconds or something.
No, it's not 45 seconds. I guarantee it's not 45. Like, you can use a small snippet without a problem, but 45 seconds is, you know, a third of a song almost. So no, it's not 45 seconds. You could not know. You can use the slightest snippet.
See, this tells you just how
the episode was. The most interesting thing about it is their attempts to get something that sounds like Highway to Hell going.
You know, and the truck driver is the most, you know, the truck driver parts are the most interesting parts. Will Wheaton doesn't get enough time to do anything.
No, like we get no background of his character. We don't know what his character thinks, feels, really anything about the character at all. We just know that he's a generic monster.
Yeah, he's sort of a generic monster who fools Aaron, and because everything else is explained.
Yeah.
You know, everything else is explained, including the hotels and the motels and stuff. And they get, well, yeah, but it's been closed. I haven't worked there. Blah, blah, blah. You know?
Yeah.
Oh, and it, okay. Yeah, it was just a blah episode.
Yeah.
And then we move to the next. I don't know.
Before we move to the next one, I just want to point out, this is important. So before we move to the next one, I did make a joke in the episode that in the script that that Will Wheaton seems to not know how to run when he runs in this episode is the most awkward thing you've ever seen. You're like, have you never run before?
Well, no, I'm trying apparently to go back to Enterprise.
No, that's not important. What's important is he had screwed up his back right before filming this episode. So no, he actually could not run when he was doing the episode. So no, this is not a judgment of Will Wheaton and his physicality. He had actually hurt himself right before starting filming this, so he could not, in fact, run in the episode. I wasn't crazy. That isn't how a person runs. But yes, so we're not gonna judge him for his role on Star Trek. Which, let's face it, he had plenty of stuff working him against him in that Star Trek situation.
Yeah,
undercut on every turn, really. Poor guy.
Yeah, you know, I mean, and yet, I mean, he's on Big Bang Theory. And
every now and then, yeah.
Every now and then and enjoying himself thoroughly.
Oh, clearly. Okay. No, I mean, I'm not saying he hasn't made a good career out of having been on Star Trek. He has, yeah. But having been on Star Trek was a rough time, too.
Yeah, all Stand right. By Me. But yeah,
oh, yeah, he was also in Stand By Me.
After
Stand By Me, which is just...
It
was after Stand By Me, yeah. It was like the
which,
next
I mean, I was just thinking about watching that again.
It's a brilliant movie. It's too depressing to ever watch, but it's a brilliant movie.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on to episode 2, Catching Out, the Killer Hobo episode.
Yes. The BAU investigates a series of murders in California's Central Valley that appear to be committed by an unsub who chooses the victims based on their proximity to the railway. Meanwhile, JJ introduces the team to prospective replacement Jordan Todd, a counterterrorism agent who is fiercely devoted to her job. I don't know how you would ever know that from this episode.
No, there's literally nothing about her character in the episode to make you think that she is fiercely devoted to her job, especially since she's introduced as someone who is desperate to get out of counterterrorism and start working in the BAU.
Yeah, and who profiles Derek.
Yeah. Like
at the beginning.
It's pretty funny, but it's like, in fact, I would say the opposite about her. I would say she's not someone who's too psyched about being involved in counterterrorism work and would rather work serial killers. Although later she will find out that it is way harder, apparently, to catch serial killers than it is to catch terrorists. Although that is something I would have. We can have a whole other conversation.
We'll have that conversation later on.
Oh, she's, we absolutely
she's
not will.
A, she. They don't get a very sympathetic character in here. So
no.
I mean,
were they worried about making someone who might want to replace JJ full time? Like, what? Why do we get a character who's just not that sympathetic?
Yeah. Well, no. I mean, the thing is that JJ, it was a real pregnancy, right?
Oh.
Every time she was pregnant, they were real pregnancies, in fact. Oh. And so it was her actual son who shows up on the show every time.
I had no idea. Okay.
Her actual son. Yeah.
I had no idea. That makes perfect sense. All right. Yeah. Now I know why they just had a character to jump in there for a second. So yeah, that part of the episode is wholly unimportant.
They kind of have to do that sort of because you never know how long she's going to be out.
Yeah, of course.
With the pregnancy, right?
You're right. Like you can't predict that at all. So I totally get that. And you know what? Now I know what they were doing with this character more and she actually makes a lot more sense. But this episode, it's weird because, again, there's so little here to grasp onto. The guy is just, you know, pretty generic monster. He just loves murdering people and stealing their stuff. Like, there's almost no depth to this. Like, they talk to his brother, so we get a little bit of psychology to it. right? But when but it comes too down late. To it, so late in the episode, they already know who the killer is at that point. And all the stuff they, it's weird because they do all the stuff where they talk to the brother and, you know, I mean, the brother is tormented by he feels like he failed his brother and blah, 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 blah. But I'm like, at the same time, none of this is really relevant to catching the guy, is it? Because you catch him because you find out the group of migrant workers he was traveling with.
Yeah.
Like, and that's pretty much it. Like, they figure out, okay, he's probably a migrant worker or was. So who is it? And it's weird how long it takes them to figure out the killer based on the fact that he leaves fingerprints all over the house and is a known criminal. Like, should he have really gotten to 5 brutal, you know, mass murders if he left fingerprint, bloody fingerprints, or just regular fingerprints all over the crime scene, and he was in the, he was already in the database as a criminal? Seems weird that it took them as long as it did, to me. But yeah, because if you think about it, all that really happens in this episode is they have Penelope check who's going, like, where the groups of people are traveling. Okay, well, there's been one group of people traveling who there's in every town that a murder happened. So it's and it's the only group of farm workers who are in every town where a murder happened. So the guy is probably connected to them. And they know who he is by then, so they just go around with his photograph until there's someone to talk to about it. Like, okay. Seems like this should have been more difficult than it was.
Was he in a...
He was, and then he gets kicked out, and getting kicked out of the group is what makes a...
No, but wasn't he a criminal... No, wasn't he a criminal in Mexico?
I think he was a criminal here, too, because, again, they have his fingerprint. Like, the minute they get his, they find out who it is, they check, and they're like, yes, his fingerprints were all over the crime scene. I think he was a criminal in America, too, because they have his fingerprints right away, faster than you'd think they would if they were getting them from Mexico.
No, they just called some friend in Tijuana.
Maybe that is it.
Magical Tijuana, like, magical Mexico.
That's true.
Penelope.
Right. Penelope can handle that kind of thing.
This was... Yeah, again, the problem with this episode, and this is where you start to see in season 4 things, you start to get a lot more of the blah episodes.
Yeah, where episodes that are just marking time, that don't have anything to say.
Yeah, that don't have, really aren't even trying.
No.
You know? I mean, the guy's a tweaker. Well, okay. Why? But
he sniffs glue. Okay, great.
Well, but, and then he has, and like the visuals, it's Charles Hayde who actually directed this episode.
Yeah.
You have the visuals, which aren't bad. Okay, he does all of this kind of stuff. Okay,
so. But there's not a ton of artistry to this. Yeah.
No, you've got a severe dissociative personality. He's hopping the rails.
Yeah.
I mean, the biggest thing they do is scream and holler because they gave him a name.
I know. And that'll keep. Yeah, that is the one thing from the world of actual serial killer profiling is that when you name someone, it can
hamper.
It can create preconceptions that interfere with the investigation. They're like, Gary Ridgway was burying women throughout the forest, but we never found them because we were just watching the river because people called him the Green River Killer. Also, there's no practical way to search a forest. Mm-hmm. That's the other reason you didn't find them.
Yeah, I mean, you could take dogs, but it could take you forever, or you could have ground-penetrating radar.
Yeah, you'd have to have the slightest idea there was a body there, and you didn't.
Well, like, no one
was putting any work into finding Gary Ridgway. Most of the time, he was killing sex workers. Okay, like, they say the hunt for the Green River Killer, it's an interesting hunt, but it's not like they were spending hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions of dollars, really, to search all, they were going to search throughout all of the forests
around there
to try and find him. That's just not how they operate.
Okay, we'll take this back to Frank.
Yeah. Okay.
He'd been doing it for 20 years.
Right.
And they never put a lot of money. And your complaint that after, you know, Gideon says, we're going to get you, and they don't even bother looking for him, right?
They don't even look for him.
Yeah. So
it's shocking. You know,
there's a little basis in reality there.
Yeah, that's true.
If you want to connect.
Yeah, I mean, mentions Frank the rest of the year.
Yeah. Until no way
out. It's time for him to show up and, you know, get killed. It's just funny watching the episode because you're like, I understand your mindset, Aaron, but I don't think it's really as big of an issue as you're suggesting it is. Because, frankly, what do you call it? In the Gary Ridgway case, it's just not true that their efforts were massively hampered by not knowing. Here, they are right. The efforts are hampered by only look on the I-99 corridor because... Yeah. There were other similar murders in other states. And there's a shout out to the fact that people do not federally file their violent crime statistics in America, which makes it incredibly difficult to catch roving serial killers. Because, like you said, that's the genius in Canada. You only get funding if you... like, we're going to cut off all your funding if you don't submit
your data all of your crime stats database.
To the central database. And that's why VICAP works so much better in Canada than it does in America. Because America is not willing to just put their foot down and say, no, this isn't optional.
It was the Paul Bernardo case.
Yep.
It was too much because they could have caught him if they had some kind of a database because he was the Scarborough rapist and they had the Scarborough rapist's fingerprints.
Yeah.
Right. Ugh. And all of this sort of stuff. And there was no interaction between all of these different police
all
departments
in Ontario. Yeah. And I mean, that's all just in Ontario, but they still were not interacting the way they should have been. And now hopefully that can't happen again. I mean, we don't know for sure, but hopefully that specific problem, there are still any number of reasons that it's hard to catch a serial killer. The guy they caught last year, he was not getting caught because he was just killing gay men.
Yeah, you know? And he was a landscaper, so he was burying his jobs.
Yeah, that was so terrible.
That was just terrible. And the police wouldn't take it seriously. One cop, he certainly was suspended. I don't know if he ended up being fired or not, but one cop who was involved in that.
Yeah, it's like you think it's the 2010s, people. Like, and we're still living in a world of the movie Cruising, where the cops wouldn't believe that there's a serial killer running around killing gay men, because gay men are animals who just stab each other all the time anyway. I'm like, Jesus Christ.
Well,
I've seen the movie Cruising. It's rough.
You know, but it's the same thing as with women and rape. You know, there are still guys going around, you know. Well, you know, women are asking for it when they dress provocatively.
Don't get me started on that.
Oh God!
Fun thing about this episode, though, is it's another great example of like super, super strict typecasting. They're like, okay, we need someone to play a crazy junkie. Who should it be? Bubbles from The Wire. Okay.
I know it.
Poor
those
Andre
of you who
Royo.
Haven't seen The Wire,
you should see The Wire.
HBO, Crave.
It's everywhere.
Wherever. The Wire is really good. Absolutely fabulous, and Bubbles is wonderful.
Yeah, Bubbles is amazing on the show, and it's why we have Idris Elba. So there you go.
Oh my God, yes.
I know. That's why we have Idris Elba now, because he got The Wire. It's not all of his British work that got him into America's, into Hollywood's crosshairs. Although I think Luther did help. Anyway, let's move on to the important episodes this week. Oh, wait! The one thing that I wanted to mention that was so funny is the previous episode ends with them chasing down Will Wheaton, and Will Wheaton runs in front of a truck and gets killed.
Yeah.
And this episode ends with them chasing down Bubbles, and he tries to get on a train, and he gets killed. Like, they have literally the exact same ending two episodes in a row. They're having a foot chase, and then the guy gets killed. It's pretty weird. And it's like, it's one of those things where you're like, did you really not notice? Did you not see what you were doing? All right, so next up, Instincts.
Yes, so we have two episodes. One is called The Instincts, and the other one is Memoriam.
All right, let's start with Instincts.
Okay, Instincts. So they end up in Las Vegas because they've got a dead 5-year-old child, and then you have another child being abducted.
Yeah.
Approximately the same age. And it's in Las Vegas. The BAU, for some reason, gets... I don't care. Anyway.
It doesn't matter why they get dragged down.
When a 5-year-old child is found dead in Las Vegas, another child is abducted soon afterwards, the BAU attempts to link the two crimes. Meanwhile, Reed suffers from dreams that force him to recall forgotten childhood memories.
Yes. All right. And that is perfect description of the episode. Nothing wrong there.
No.
It's interesting, this episode, because there is this deep focus on Reed, which is not the first or last time we're going to do that. But, oh my God, it's not until the second episode that things get really interesting. So let's buzz through this first episode so we can get talking about the important one. It's one of those weird things when you watch a show like this that happens all the time, and I think there's no way around it. The voice coding stuff, the voices they have these people do, it just sounds like a woman when you first hear it. You know? Like, there's no way around that. It just does. And that's not a judgment. It's not her performance that it's bad, but it's like, you have a hard time believing anyone could have listened to that recording and thought that it was a man. You know? Because, like, that's so clearly a woman on the phone. No judgment. She does a fine performance, but that's obviously a woman on the phone. And I don't think it's plausible that you could believe it was anything but a woman on the phone. That's a minor complaint. That's not a big deal, but it is definitely noticeable.
Well, yeah, but the funny thing about that, I mean, just talking about that particular case, of course, we all know the second child, because he was alive, will not be dead. So
you have to be a teenager before they kill you if we meet you when you're alive.
Yeah, you know, so we've got this little child. I think the parents are well written.
Yep. Oh, it's Reed Diamond. Come on, you got Reed Diamond.
Oh yeah, well yeah, you've got Reed Diamond in it.
He's fantastic.
Yeah.
You've got this great presentation of the like conflict that arises between them, because she does not know how to stop from blaming her husband for their child's disappearance, which is rough, but you totally believe it from the characters.
Oh, well, you believe, and that's it. You believe it from the characters, because I can put myself in.
Yeah.
In fact, I mean, once just not being told where a child was sent me into spasm. I practically, you know, I'm screaming and hollering.
Yeah.
At my husband at the time, just screaming and hollering. I mean, the child ended up being okay, but I'm just screaming and hollering.
It's terrifying.
Because I'm running all over looking for this child.
Yeah.
And they'd gone with his dad. Well,
leave a message. Make a phone call. Explain the situation.
You know?
Yeah, you can't know. Anyway. You always want to know where your kids are. Like, I totally understand that.
And that kind of panic, and certainly my mother had it when I kind of disappeared once, but it turns out I was fine. But
no, like, you know where these parents are coming from, and like,
you can actually see it, you know? And the father had said, well, you know, he was so proud that he could walk to his friends by himself.
Yeah.
You know, and nobody expects. The only thing that I would say, and in terms of you're talking about the voice recording, you know, it's a woman. Well, I'd ignore that part. But the fact that the child wasn't sexually abused.
That's a really good hint. Should have
been their first, was dead after a week and wasn't sexually abused, should have been their first clue right off the top that this was not one of your sexual predator abductions.
Yeah.
That's it. That there was something else going on right from the top, but then, you know.
Then you wouldn't have the mid-episode. Yeah, you need to kill some time in the episode. You need them to have a couple of bad ideas before they get to the good ideas, but you're right. Like, the key question is this kid molested? And the second you know the kid wasn't molested, you can usually dismiss a man as the perp. Usually.
Yeah, I'm not saying always, but but at least that should have broadened their idea, given the screaming that Aaron did the week before about the Highway 91 killer.
Yeah. You don't want to close off or make these assumptions.
You wonder sometimes, does this writing room, do they not talk to one another when they're writing these episodes?
No, like, I don't know.
Person is key. Usually one or two people are key. But
I think a lot of them don't. Yeah.
And they should be, even
more consistent than they are. Yeah.
Yeah, than they are about these sorts of things. Okay, well, Aaron did this. It's no wonder Aaron got so mad periodically about the way his character was written.
Yeah, I get it. Because there is a lot of inconsistency. And it's frustrating because you're right. Last week, his whole thing was don't make assumptions.
Like, don't make assumptions.
Don't do or even think anything that's going to close off your mind to other possibilities, because that is how bad things happen. It's like, yeah, that's you're talking about this exactly right, Aaron. And then that exact thing happens this week.
The next time. And then you go back to the unsub where, yes, the profiler makes assumptions and he lays into her.
Yeah.
Right? In front of the entire team.
Yeah.
And that's
no, and that was a theme on UMSUB a couple of times.
Yeah. That's
where it's like, it's natural when you think you own the stats, like when you think you completely understand the statistics and when you think statistics are all that matters, you become blind to the messiness of human nature. And that is what, is what they shouldn't have done this time. Again, it all ends up happily. They find the kid and, there's this moment where they're like, is she going to throw the kid into a fire? Well, she's holding something baby-sized, and she kidnapped a 5-year-old, so no, she's not about to throw the kid into the fire. Like, it's like all the characters forgot she didn't, like, she thinks she kidnapped a baby, but she didn't. It's like the characters think she kidnapped a baby for that moment. I'm like... Yeah. No, that's not what's happening this episode. It's just a teddy bear, though. It's fine.
Yeah.
But the whole time that Reed is down there, he is thinking about, he keeps having recurring nightmares about a dead kid in a basement.
Yeah, and he never sees sort of the person. And the thing is, he's going back to Las Vegas.
Yep.
And he gets, I mean, this is basic PTSD because it all gets triggered, right?
Yes.
He goes to the funeral and he knows that he's been to a funeral before.
Yep.
So clearly when he was, I still don't believe that kid was 4, but anyway.
That's another conversation.
At some point it says he was 4, but I would have thought.
No, they specifically say that he was 4. Well. Yeah, they specifically say he was 4 when the death happened.
Yeah, and I'm going... Okay,
no,
but I ignored that, right?
You know what? Casting is casting. Don't complain about casting.
Yes, I get. Never mind. Shut up, Sheila. So what happens, right? So he does have these, they're getting worse. And then of all things, right? He discovers who it is.
Yeah.
And...
He thinks that his dad might have killed this kid because he has a flashback to his dad when his dad's dream. Face appears in his dream. That is what he thinks. So now we cut to the next episode where he wants to stay in town to keep working on this case.
Okay, but
and
just,
yeah. they no, no oh, you, what were you going to say before the next episode?
No, go on. It's
and then we start off with another false sounding moment where he asks Joe Montaigne if he can stay in town, and Joe's like, sure, that's fine. I'm like, yeah, that's not your job, Joe. You're not his boss. No. He shouldn't be asking you. You shouldn't be giving him permission.
No, and Derek shouldn't be either.
No, this is entirely Aaron should be the one giving him permission. And if then Joe and Derek say we want to stay and help him out, Aaron should say fine. But he should be looped in on this decision. Like, he's the boss. You guys are... I know Joe Montaigne is the most famous person, but he's not the boss. And this is the second time we've had a scene where they act like Joe is the boss. And it, I don't know why it bothers me so much, but it really does.
Well, it does. I mean, it does. It's there had to have been like Aaron, like Thomas Gibson gets kept right up to the season 12.
Right.
Season 12 it is, right?
Yeah.
But you can see that there had to be behind the scenes tension.
Okay.
Probably not with Brunero, but I suspect that tension increases. Like, I would say season 4 is when sort of Brunero is kind of
segueing out.
Starts segueing out and losing sort of, or he's, when was some, when
season
was,
5 is when the spinoff happens. The backdoor pilot happens in season 5.
Okay, so here's 4.
Yeah.
Okay, so he's probably already thinking about that.
Yes.
Or whatever, probably. Or thinking about something else. I don't know what's going on. But this just with the Aaron Hotchner character, there's something kind of wonky about it. And
yeah.
And as I told you before about that website that they just stopped. Aaron was gone and the show can't go on without Aaron, so they just stopped watching.
Yeah.
You know?
No, a lot of people feel that way about the character, I think.
Yeah, no. It is ultimately when you look at it a whole, I'm sure at the end of, you know, when we get to season 12 and then you look at everything that's happened since, it's like,
you'll notice the drop off. But yeah, you just see why I thought it was strange to see them dismissing Aaron in that way. Like, I really did.
It felt
dismissive.
It's a writing room thing.
Yeah.
I'm sure, you know, and nobody picks up on that, right? Nobody has probably sat down and said, by the way, Aaron Hotchner is the boss.
Yeah.
Now,
so
that doesn't mean that you couldn't have had a tiny little scene where, you know, Joe talks to Aaron and Aaron says, sure, you know, because somebody had to let Joe and Derek stay behind in Las Vegas
exactly.
as well.
And I mean, I'm sure maybe we can assume that scene happened off camera.
Or it got cut. Yeah.
It got cut for time. Yeah, there you go. Like that kind of thing happens all the time.
Yeah, and
it feels weird. All I'm saying is it feels weird that Aaron is not looped in on this conversation.
Okay, and what's really funny, now I'm going to bring up sort of what in the first episode, Reed is talking about his dreams, right? And, you know, and Derek says, yeah, but, you know, dreams are supposed to mean something.
Yeah.
You know, and Reed's going, oh, no. they dismissed Freud completely. And then Derek says, yeah, but, or was it, no. And then Reed goes, Jung. And I'm going, if you want to talk what pissed me off about this episode, right, is we get this Jungian crap in these two episodes because it's there. And I'm going, wait a sec, you know, like Reed's going, oh, well, Freud's just been dismissed. Excuse me? Yeah, there's a lot of Freud that, you know, the dream stuff is not so. Jung's dream stuff is crazy.
Yes.
You know?
Well, you get into this collective unconscious stuff.
Oh, good God, help me.
That is just crazy nonsense. Because I'm not defending the idea of the collective unconscious. It's crazy nonsense, but that's what it's built around.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, yeah. And the thing is that it's Jung that would tell you that your dreams don't mean anything because they're tapping into the archetypes of the collective unconscious, not Freud. Freud is clear that he gets wrong what they mean. But Freud is pretty clear that all of this stuff goes back into the childhood.
Yeah, and that, it's your mind processing
stuff.
That
he leaves behind from, I am going to defend Freud here on the basis... Wow. Well, no, on the basis of his first paper, and then of course he changes his mind and comes
he
up.
He sold
with
every. He sold out all of his patients because polite society didn't want to hear it.
Well, no, they didn't. No, it wasn't polite society that didn't want to hear it. It was his academic peers.
And I was fitting them in with polite society. I'm just talking about.
Yeah, I just haven't spent enough time in an academic setting.
That's true.
And. No, I mean, he was going to lose his patience. So he, because what he said was his patients had been sexually abused by family members.
Yeah. And society was not ready to hear that then. What's that? They're still not ready to hear it today? Oh, okay.
You know, and you can go and read. I mean, that paper is now available, but for a long time, it just sat in the Freudian archives.
Yeah.
And, but he, sure. I mean, he had a, what you would call, He changed his mind about this turned out to be, well, no. There were these drives, right? And then he created this drive.
Unconscious drives, theory, Oedipus, Electra, blah, 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 blah.
All that sort of crap. But yep. He never left this idea that there are things in childhood, and he's the one, and he did talk about screen memories, and he was much more practical. I'm not saying Freud was right about, because it's the crap that he was so wrong about that grab the imagination of the world, which is the Oedipus complex.
Yeah.
You'll notice it's the Oedipus complex as opposed to the Electra. And and when we talk about evil mothers,
yeah, I know.
Our minds are going, there you've got the Oedipus complex. You all hate mothers.
Yeah.
Right. Because you all want to have sex with your mothers? Are you out of your mind?
I know.
Give me a friggin' break. But the Jungian stuff, and it comes up like, you know, and then what's his face is talking. No, this was a real thing that had happened to him when he was 4 years old, and he misinterpreted everything that he saw.
Well, it's fun. It's kind of funny that they specifically call out Freud as being useless when there's a literal screen memory in this episode.
Yeah.
Like, that's something Freud talked about, guys. Yeah, and how do you completely dismiss his concepts?
You know, and he hates his father. But he refuses to accept that he sees his father as the murderer of this little boy because he hates his father.
Yeah. Oh.
Because he was abandoned by his father. And
again,
no.
It's like the subtext of the Reed character is the most fascinating thing about this show.
Yeah.
Like, I think it really is, because you've got, as you just pointed out, he desperately wants his father to be the killer.
Yeah.
So that he will have a good reason. His father will have had a good reason for leaving him with his horrible mother.
Yeah.
But his father doesn't have a good reason.
He can't say his horrible mother.
Yeah. But he can't. But it's like, of course he needed to be. And the thing is, he as much says it in this episode. Like, he doesn't say, why couldn't you have rescued me from her? But that's what he's saying at the end of the episode.
Well, yeah, and that's the big question. I have Reed's question.
Yeah.
Why?
I agree.
It will come up again throughout these Criminal Minds. You know, the father comes up again, and he has these other things, right? And you're just going, you're looking at the father leaving and the mother, don't take him with me. Well, yeah, but, and then he just never comes back and rescues him as the mother is getting worse and worse. And he knows what the mother has done.
Yeah.
I mean, it is the mother. Now,
he knows the mother helped with a murder.
Okay, here's the interesting thing about this episode again.
Go.
This, as with the episode with Reed in, when he begins his drug addiction.
Yes, of course.
The sex episode.
Yeah.
Right? Where you have the pictures of the boy and the mother and all of these things, right? And you have all of that. That was Guy Norman Bee. This episode, again, is Guy Norman Bee as the director.
It's so amazing. Like, it's like they had this one great director working there. And then he leaves to go and do Supernatural full time. And I guess the closest thing they have to a great director of that, Ifter, is Matt Gubler, who has fascinating, if wildly uneven, episodes.
Yeah. You know, there are a few other directors that aren't too bad, you know.
No, they do good jobs, but I'm
saying,
like,
they don't have an awful lot of consistency going forward. I think Glenn Kershaw.
Safe to say. Yeah, no, Glenn Kershaw, obviously. But I think I'm safe to say that Guy Norman Bee is the best director they worked with.
Yeah, Felix Alcala hangs around, but then
he does a good job.
Too, probably gets other work.
I'm sure.
Charles Haid is only in for, I think, a couple of years. Yeah, Simon Mirren is now now directing episodes.
Oh, has he directed episodes? We'll talk about them when we get there.
Guy Norman B. again, like this whole thing, Guy wants to blame his father so he can have
Reed.
Reed wants to blame his father so he can have a real reason
why his father left him with his mother.
Why the father left with the mother, and why that, in other words, the mother kicked him out, essentially.
Yeah, that is what happened. We basically saw that in Revelations already, but it is presented in a more concrete fashion here.
Yeah, and then the father says, but I couldn't, like, and that to me, that's still the question after this that I never get a satisfactory, is Reed is such a freaking mess because there's no explanation why this father never had contact with his son again.
No.
Why? Like that, even all of this, like it explains why the father would have left, and she's not crazy yet. Okay.
No, she's not fully crazy yet.
She's not fully crazy yet. Okay. He can't face her because she was responsible for the death of this other human being.
Yeah.
Okay.
You probably shouldn't have left your son with her then.
But why are you? Well, I know. And I can even tell you why. Because she did it to protect her son.
Yeah.
Okay.
And she really believed she was protecting him from
this
psycho.
And so he says, she's not going to do anything to hurt
him,
her boy.
Yeah.
But if he had kept in contact with them, he would have seen her falling apart.
Yeah.
Like, I do not understand why the father wasn't called. Like, here, this woman is a schizophrenic. This woman is going crazy. You telling me nobody noticed this?
For years.
He's in school. Yes, he's bright. Is she able to pull off, she's got schizophrenia, and she's able to pull off her crazy to everybody that social services didn't ever get called? You know,
it beggars another, belief.
Somebody
it beggars
didn't
belief.
Get in touch with his father? Like, that part of it is...
It's a stretch.
It, to me, is still... I know that there are horrible fathers in the world, but why does she come off as the evil mother when he walked out completely?
Oh, I agree.
And left this child with this woman.
Yeah.
So, you know, she's, and it's true, but she's got no base, no grasp of reality. And I think
part of what's so fascinating about this episode is it's not that it's unwilling to, well, a little unwilling to, because the show has this fundamental they touch on, but they don't accept how toxic the relationship with the mother was.
Yeah.
Like, it's almost as if they're trying to give the dad a bit of a pass.
Yeah.
Because by saying, oh, well, you know, Jane Lynch wasn't that bad. She was terrible. She broke Reed. He's unable to have normal human relationships. Because of the way she treated him, the way she raised him, the way she isolated him, the way she allowed his intellect to isolate him. Because that didn't just happen.
No. And the father is trying. The father is trying as much as he can to give Reed a semblance of a life and friends.
Yeah.
Right? Okay. I grant you, you know, it's really usually kids who are really smart aren't necessarily good physically and
great baseball. With other people.
Yeah, you know. So it it's
happens.
A learned skill.
Absolutely.
It's a learned skill. But the thing is, his father was trying, and then that all stops.
Yeah. Yeah, his father was trying to socialize him, and it all goes away after this murder.
And that's what I don't... And it's interesting, because she goes off her meds so she can remember...
Yeah.
And it is the father and the mother who tell Reed together.
Yeah.
You know, because the father is feeling really now, is still has had this guilt. He's never had another relationship.
Nope.
It's not like he got married again and had a bunch of kids.
He doesn't have another set of kids running around.
No, he never had another relationship, and he just is obsessed with his work. Like it turns out that his dad was probably some, well, his dad was just damaged by the fact that the mother, I mean, the fact that he burned her clothes and
all of this sort of stuff. It's, you get, like, I get why that would be shattering to their relationship. Mm-hmm. Like, I get that. But at the same time, take your kid out of there. And you can say, well, she was already, the kid was already so socialized in some of the, by the mother's insanity. And it's like, he was worried that the mother was going to snap and hurt him, maybe, blah, blah, blah. But he was only four at that time, and she wasn't fully crazy yet.
She wasn't crazy yet. She was just being protective.
Yeah.
And, but it's that she would go to this length.
Yeah.
These lengths. And it makes it like she didn't know what this guy would do.
Yeah.
You know, she knew what this guy would do. Of course. She told
him. His child had been raped and murdered. And she pointed out, she didn't go to the cops.
No.
She went to the dad.
Yeah. And told
him. Of course she knew what he was going to do.
Yeah.
Like, that doesn't happen accidentally. No, she knew.
No, and the thing is,
because she saw her child being threatened.
Yeah.
She thought her child might have been next. And she's like, this guy's got to go.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying she was wrong. But I'm saying that she could have gone to the cops with her suspicions. There had been a murder in the neighborhood weeks earlier, and now this creep is creeping on her son.
And
the cops would have looked into that. The guy was a known child molester.
Yeah, he was a known child molester.
But she didn't. She wanted the guy dead, and she contrived to make that happen.
Yeah, and that's what the father can't stand. What I don't understand is why the father leaves. The son.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's no way
completely with the mother. Never has any contact with his son again.
Doesn't reach out to him at all. I know. It's inexcusable. Like, it really is in this situation. It's inexcusable. And to a certain extent, it's what the writers were locked into with decisions they had made in the first season. I would have liked it if we had found out that he had tried to reach out and, you know, like, the mother had done something crazy to scare him off and keep him away.
Yeah.
I think that would have been more believable. Because when you see how devoted this guy is to his son, you really do have to ask, well, then why didn't you do anything?
Yeah. You know, and she, you know, and there might have been a fight or whatever. But the thing is that if it went to court, he would have to say why. But once she was schizophrenic, I mean, it's clear why. But before that, if he had wanted, when he left, to take his son with him, that she would have fought him tooth and nail.
Oh, well, yes.
And the only way he would have been able to have...
to expose
clear
the murder. Yeah.
Was to expose the murder.
Yeah. Which he wasn't
going to
do.
Which he wasn't going to do because it would have meant his wife would have ended up in jail as an accessory after the fact.
Yep.
And yeah, like, this guy was
that
his friend,
part.
Right?
But so, once she was clearly having these schizophrenic episodes, you should have come back.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, and it's clear from Revelations, just like all of this is so you
that
understand.
She had been bad for a while.
Yeah, why Reed is so incapable, because that is the one consistency.
Yeah.
They're relatively consistent with Reed to a point, up to this point. I won't say
that is. Don't spoil. No spoilers.
No,
but,
no.
Yeah.
He may have some control. He may have more control. Well, he's around all the time, right?
That's true.
This is the thing that we say, that he's around all the time, so he gets to control his character a little bit better. Although it's clear from the commentary on Revelations that he did not understand what was going on in that episode.
Yeah.
Okay.
He did, though. He did, and that's why that episode works so well.
And that's why this episode works, even though we're left with this unresolved, well, why didn't the father continue some kind of a relationship at least with his son? But the mother, but that was always going to be when he saw the mother, he was, because he had to be conflicted about telling her, and the child was clearly attached to his mother.
Yep.
Right. And, you know, so I can sort of accept that. And there are, you see, if the father had been portrayed as this guy who walked out on his son and the crazy wife and went off and did his own thing, got married again, had a bunch of kids, did a whole bunch of other stuff like that. Okay. I would say, so he was just an asshole.
But that's not what happened.
And so it does make it a little more difficult to understand that supposedly he never, ever tried.
Reached out in any way. Yeah.
Reached out in any way, even though he had a difficult time interacting with his son. The son's too smart, right?
Yeah.
It's hard. It's too old for his age. That's all there is to it. The brain is just too old for its age and for its chronological age. And
no, that's clear what you meant.
Yeah. But that's what you're left with this. It's nice that he at least gets to sort of think about all of this and change sort of. It changes his understanding. The problem is that, and I don't think that the rest of the episodes now, I may be wrong. And as we go along, I may be wrong about this, but I don't think they ever really connect a lot of his breakdowns, because he continues to break down periodically, with the fact that this is, you know how with serial killers, they're always looking for, okay, what turned him into a serial killer? What do you call that?
The stressor.
The stressor.
Yeah.
This is the stressor.
Yeah.
And this is the stressor. All of a sudden, this mother turns out to be everything that Reed in the previous 3 years.
Yeah.
And some episodes... Reed doesn't want killing. Reed doesn't want, just go back to third identity, life, right?
Third life.
Third life, where he's talking to this guy. No, you can't, right?
Yeah.
You just can't, you can't. And he
and
does
his mother
this
is the exact kind of revenge / justice killer.
Yeah. She's a revenge / justice killer. That Reed is opposed to.
And he's completely opposed to, yeah.
Yeah. So all of a sudden, he has got this mother that he's been taking care of and that he feels sorry for and who loves him. And
deeply like deeply unhealthy relationship with,
Well, yeah, but he doesn't think of it that way.
No, of
not
course
really,
not.
Right?
But and yeah, she betrays him by being this person.
And he... All of us, like, he's created a massive image of his mother. He doesn't even see what is obvious to other people. Like, there's something really wrong, as Penelope points out. Oh, the therapy coach, right? You know, with the Tristan and his whole thing on Valentine's Day. Oh, okay.
Right
early on, you know, even Penelope knows this. This is glossed over. Yeah. But the thing is that this is the stressor. His mother is just the opposite, as it turns out. She is self-involved. She is narcissistic. She couldn't give a shit about Reed. Everything is about her, and she is a revenge justice killer.
Yep.
And
it's fascinating.
And it's not said that in the episode, but this is the stressor that Reed never truly recovers from. That he has.
This is going to be fascinating watching this thread through the rest of the show.
Yeah, because remember, I mean, we get massive drug issues again.
We get massive drug issues again. We have his, you know, complete inability to have a non-Tristan and Isolde writing letters to each other type of relationship.
Yep.
That's not Tristan and Isolde. That's the other one. Oh God, who's the letter writing one?
The
knight and the lady, and they're apart for 20 years, and they write the letters, and God, I'm blanking on this name. This is so embarrassing.
Yeah, I know.
Abelard and Heloise.
Thank you. Yes.
Oh.
Well,
oh,
yes,
God.
But you know Abelard and Heloise, right? I mean, poor old Abelard gets castrated.
I know. It's not a happy story, but that's the kind of relationship he has with his girlfriend.
Well, except that, except. That Reed is basically castrated male.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's true.
You know, I mean, at this point, I doubt he's ever had sex with anyone.
Well, yeah, that's a real question that I don't know that the show has ever addressed.
You know? I mean, did he actually have sex with that girlfriend that he wrote the letters?
I don't think so.
I don't think they ever.
No, they never met in person.
I swear to God, has he ever had sex?
That's a good question. You know what? We're going to keep analyzing this going forward. So, basically, as you heard,
Abelard Eloise, I like that.
But it's accurate to who he sees himself as, to how he behaves, like how he thinks male-female relationships are supposed to be. Chaste medieval courting. Like that's his idea. But anyway, well, yes, so just to take one more look at this episode before we move on. Let's take one more look at the episode, and let's all take a note that a guy's son got murdered, and he did what many would call the right thing. They could have just gone to the cops, but I understand why he did what he did. He murdered the guy who did it, and everything was fine for 20 years. And then because Reed couldn't let well enough alone, now this guy's got to go to jail. Thanks, Reed.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what I thought. Thanks, Reed. You can't let this go, eh? No, my father has to have had something to do with this. No, it was your mother, honey.
No, it was your mother.
It was your mother.
Your father's honey, not a great guy, and he shouldn't have left you with you, but your mother's the real villain here.
In this particular... And the funny thing is you know the police captain suspects. And
of course he does.
Of course he does. Right? He pretty much has an idea and wants to let it slide. The guy was a scumbag. Let it lay.
Let it go.
Now, I do not think that this guy is going to spend
any meaningful time in jail. No, I'm sure you're right.
He might even get probation.
He might get probation for killing that guy.
Well, it was 20
years ago. I mean, what jury is... It's 20 years ago. He's lived an exemplary life, we assume, for the next 20 years. And what jury is going to convict him for murdering the guy who raped and murdered his son?
Oh, I don't even think. I think that his lawyer and the DA are going to come...
They will make an agreement to put him on...
He'll put him on probation for eight years or something. I was so... I was in a state of complete rage and anger, and so I just let it all out. I killed him. It wasn't really deliberate.
Yeah, irresistible compulsion.
Irresistible compulsion, and I'm really... Well, I can't say that I'm sorry.
He can't say he's sorry. He would not say he was sorry.
He may have to do something...
You're right. He may have to, depending on the judge, but...
Yeah, depending on the judge, he may have to find some way to say... Yeah, I probably, looking back on it, this is how you would do it. Looking back on it, I should have gone to the cops when I found out who it
was. But
who
again, I was overwhelmed.
Yes.
And I just ran out and did it right then, and then I covered it up.
You know, I mean, under other circumstances, but I can't go back and change those circumstances.
Yeah, you're right. That would probably, you're right. Okay, so I feel better about it now because he probably got away with it.
Yeah, but you know what? Reed's mother, is she going to come into this? Is there going to be some, she's crazy. And so she's going to get away with it too, because she is integral. If it wasn't for her, he would have never known who did it.
Nope.
And this guy...
No, this all happened because of her.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fascinating.
So she's a murderer.
Okay, so yeah.
Essentially a murderer.
Yeah, well, she's an accessory. Like you say, she's a full-stop accessory. She's not just an accessory after the fact for covering it up. She's the one who instigated the murder.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's a whole other conversation.
Yeah, and you never hear about that.
No.
You know,
fascinating.
And that, nobody talks, but at least with Guy Norman Bee directing this and directing the back seat, like the flashback scenes and everything else.
Yep.
Right. You get like, he does it so well.
Oh yeah.
Just does it so well that you can pick up all of those nuances. And then we end. I mean, that's the bizarre part, right? Is you end this scene on this. Up note.
Yeah, I know.
And she gives birth to Henry.
Such a happy ending to the episode.
Godmother, and Penelope gets to be the godmother.
Worst choice for a godfather ever.
Ever.
Oh my God. He's had a rough week. You couldn't have made a worse choice for your godfather. he is not going to be there for the kid ever. And If the role of the godfather is to ensure, correct religious instruction, whether or not you believe that, whether or not that's why you're doing it, Worst choice for that, too.
Well, moral and ethical, whatever.
Yes, moral and ethical. If you want to say, not religious instruction, but if you want to say he's responsible for his moral and ethical development, then he's also bad for that. Yeah. Oh, yeah, the drug.
And we have just found out that his mother
murdered somebody.
Is a murderer. I know. His father,
ran out on him. Like, again, I know you feel bad for him. Yes, covered up and then ran out. I know you feel bad for him, but don't screw up Henry's life via proximity to Reed.
Yeah.
I'm sure, you know what? I'm sure it'll be fine. Let's just be positive and be sure it'll be fine.
Yeah, because nothing, well, yes.
No, nothing bad's happening to Henry. We're going to put our foot down on that one.
Yes, yes. And the next boy. All right.
Let's wrap that bad boy up here.
Yes.
Let's stop this here. I'm so glad we did these back to back because there's so much to talk about with Reed's character. And expect to hear a lot more of our thoughts on Reed's character going forward. I think this is going to become a regular feature. Just us delving into the psychosexual nightmare that is Reed's
life.
That is Reed's inner life.
He may, because now by the end of the show, he's what? He's got to be in his 40s?
14 years of the show. When it started, he was
in his late 25,
20s. So
27.
He'll definitely be 40 by the end of the show.
Yeah, by
maybe
the end 41, of the show.
42. Who knows?
And maybe he's going to be the 40-year-old virgin.
Jesus Christ. All right. So what are the next three episodes we're going to be covering next week?
Oh, the one we love to hate.
Okay.
Masterpiece.
Such a silly episode of all right.
But it's so much fun. Paul Michael
so
Glaser.
Silly, so stupid.
And Bernero actually wrote it.
All right, next up.
52 Pickup.
We're going to be talking about Tom Cruise next week.
And Brother in Arms.
Brother in Arms. Okay, these are three solid episodes. So that's, unless I'm mistaken, 408
to 410? 408
to 410,
yeah. And
right,
this is,
Jerry's
I
back
think
here for that.
This is Breen Fraser's, 52 Pickup is Breen Fraser's first episode.
Interesting, because Breen does a lot of work on that show.
Yeah.
Fun fact, we managed to talk about a whole episode with William Mapother in it without mentioning that he's Tom Cruise's cousin. So I'm pretty proud of myself for that one. There's no reason I should be. That's just
no. I was just going to say, but you said it now.
I know. I ruined everything.
Yes, you ruined everything. You should have started next week with that.
No, it's just, it's interesting because next week we've got Tom Cruise is going to come up organically. And here, I think it kind of came up organically too.
Yeah.
So join us back here next week for those episodes. If you're listening to this via iTunes, be sure to write a review and give us a star rating because that helps people find the show. If you have any questions for us, suggestions for other profiling related media we should check out, drop us a line at profilingcriminalminds@gmail.com. We recently found out a lot of backstory about a certain Jim Clemente from a letter, which we're going to be talking about in a future episode. So be sure to check that out.
Okay.
So we will see you back here next week for those episodes. But until then, au revoir.
Good night.
Profiling Criminal Minds is a member of the Kinks Podcasting Network.